So what does Uruguay do? Every farmer has to submit soil management plans to the government. I know in the, saying that in the United States of America sounds like an alien concept, but believe me, in Latin America was an alien concept too when Uruguay started. So farmers have to submit soil management plans. And these soil management plans are being overlaid in an electronic database with soil quality maps. And if you compare the vulnerability, English Holger, the vulnerability of your soil, the slope, the soil quality, your exposure to erosion, your water content of the soil with the production plans of the farmer, then all of a sudden you might find out that certain plots are not meant to be monocropped with soy, and then Uruguay takes the liberty of keeping that farmer away from monocropping soy. So it is basically a policy under which Uruguay accumulates soil fertility. At this point in time, yes, the soy exports have gone down a little, but that is for a reason. That's because Uruguay saves. And my prediction is, our prediction is that once other countries come closer to the famous 100 harvest that the Independent quoted, Uruguay will have accumulated and will still have quite a bit of fertility left. And I make this case because it is really a showcase. What else makes it a showcase? Uruguay started 10 years ago with individual livestock registration, ear tags in cattle. Was initially motivated with health concerns, public health concerns, foot and mouth disease. One wanted to track from farm to table, from farm to fork, like it's called. But one understood early on that knowing where your livestock is located gives you an incredible tool to measure resilience. Now think, I mean, you might have seen sessions on drones and remote management, remote sensing. Now, if you want to understand where your country is most vulnerable, you just overlay all this data. Soil quality registry with soil moisture management. We do that easily from a satellite nowadays. Vegetation density, livestock density, family farm registry. And then in the wake of an incoming drought, what are the most vulnerable spots in a country? The hot spots. That's exactly where you have the lowest vegetation, the highest livestock density, the highest incidence of family farming. These are more vulnerable than corporate farmers and so on and so forth. And then the government can intervene for that very location and doesn't have to pour precious public resources into an entire county, state, or country. And I could come up with many examples of vulnerability that can now be better addressed. I'm coming to an end here. And that's not only as a reactive instrument, it's also as a preventive instrument. Because if you want to support a farm sector, a food sector, to become more resilient, you also might want to come to the market with investment incentives. And by knowing where the hotspots are, you can deploy them in a very, very targeted way. These are just little glimpses into a country and into a system that is truly stunning. Think of real-time monitoring of pesticide application because the sprayers are connected to satellite. This is all fantastic stuff. And we highlight it as the World Bank because it is one of two handful of countries worldwide at this point in time that really show that we can get to a food system that feeds everyone, everywhere, every day, with healthy food without compromising the global resources. Let me leave it here as an introductory statement. I'm looking forward to discussing this with you.
My follow-up question is, how do you really feel? more than that, I know that the many of the times I've heard people say that we have all the solutions at hand, we just don't have the will. What I'm hearing you say about Uruguay is they had the political will to do something, and they did it around some of the interventions that they've done. Where do you see this as, where do you see around the world other places having this will to have, and where it will be more effective if they had the will? Where would we be able to achieve greater closure of that gap? Not yet. We'll do questions afterwards. I'm asking, I have moderator's prerogative here to ask a follow-up question of each of the interim statements.
Lisa, how do I really feel about it? I really feel about it this way, and that's why I work on that little country, and that's why I will go there again in 3 weeks from here, because that's where I learn, right? That's not only for World Bank to come and tell, but it's more about the learning and then applying the concepts elsewhere. So I just wanted to make the point, and thanks for asking the question. It's not about Uruguay. Uruguay is one of a number of countries in Africa. It's Rwanda that is the African Uruguay. And even in Europe, European Union, a big bloc, high subsidy intensity, has a lot of exemplary elements that help creating incentives for an agriculture sector that cherishes soil health, water, and also, and perhaps most importantly, biodiversity, maintaining old breeds to maintain seed banks, gene banks that we can use to breed varieties that are more resilient to upcoming challenges, be it climate or be it others.
Thank you. Next up is Robert Engelman. Bob is a co-founder of SEJ, a former journalist, and he is now a senior researcher at World Watch. He's also the author of More, which I found to be incredibly informative on all these subjects, especially around demographics and global population and natural resources. It's available out for sale out on the book table. I read it over a long weekend. Great book.
Thank you.
The thing about land, as Will Rogers once said, is that they ain't making any more of the stuff. And Will Rogers was an Oklahoman. He was part Native American, a philosopher, comic. And that was a lead that I wrote 35 years ago, 1980, for the Kansas City Times when I was an environment reporter for the then Kansas City Times. Paper has since been absorbed by the Kansas City Star. On transformation of agricultural land for suburban sprawl and what some of the consequences were of that. And it amazed me to look up to see what the world's population was at that time. It was 4.4 billion, three-fifths of today's 7.3 billion, which is a sobering and very aging thought. But it's the fact that we don't make any more of this stuff is still true. Although, as I think Holger's talk indicated, we can improve what we have, but we don't make any more of this stuff. And it's not only still a good lead, but it's a pretty good lead into a discussion such as we're having this morning about how we feed ourselves and take care of ourselves in a world with ongoing growing population and growing per capita consumption, growing dietary aspirations. So this 1-2 punch that has been so often identified and yet isn't explored as often as I think it should be in journalism and by the media of the 1-2 punch of economic and population growth. Things we think we know but don't challenge, and I hate to challenge Holger on this, but we think we know there will be 9 billion people in 2050. But in fact, we don't know that at all, and that isn't even demographers' current best guess. The UN Population Division has been releasing projections since 2012, a group of them that now put the number, just for the median projection, at 9.6 and now 9.7, and ones that were just released a couple months ago, billion, rising to probably, we don't really know, of course, because we can't really predict or project the future, but projected to well beyond 10 billion in 2100 with no end in sight. I think it's really important for us to understand when we look at the way population interacts with these issues that we don't know when population growth will end. And we certainly don't know when economic growth will end. As a matter of fact, if anyone can find a good story projecting the end of economic growth and when that will occur, I would be very interested in seeing it. It really doesn't exist. So these are the points I'll try to make in my brief 8 minutes, 7 or 8 minutes, are around this topic. With colleagues at World Watch and a small network of researchers gathered from around the world to help with this, I've been involved in a project assessing peer-reviewed scientific research that's been published in the last 10 years around or somehow treating the linkage of family planning, the use of contraception, and environmental sustainability. Now, for some people, that's kind of like family planning, environmental sustainability. I don't know. I don't see it. And for others, it's like, well, duh. But the interesting thing is to find scientific research about this. And we're compiling our findings right now. We'll have a report out around the end of the year and then some more materials and dissemination around about it next year. But among the early findings I can reveal here at SCJ 2015 in Norman are that there is a preponderance of papers that when they look at the question of is it climate change that is more driving water scarcity, land degradation, food insecurity, and a range of issues that affect our ability to feed and shelter ourselves, or are other issues, other factors at play, overwhelmingly, not without exception, but overwhelmingly, the papers we've looked at find that this combination of population growth and per capita rises in per capita consumption, this associated human demand on the resource is by far, in most cases, the dominant impact. And many of them even project it will be for quite some time. We don't know how much climate change we've really seen to date, but we have good demographic records and we have pretty good records on consumption, so we can make some analyses about that. I'll give you just two examples to be brief. One of them is very much in the news today. The one that isn't so much is a paper that was published about Lake Urmia in northwestern Iran, which is disappearing like the Aral Sea. The paper was actually called the Aral Sea Syndrome and the desiccation of Lake Urmia. And these researchers, all Iranians, several of them women, examined the history of precipitation, drought, temperature, and uses of water in this very productive large lake in Iran, which is about 80-some percent of it has disappeared, totally destroying the, well, damaging the ecology and destroying the tourism industry there. And their conclusion was that climate change was not the culprit, as many people had suspected, that overwhelmingly the culprit was inefficient, wrong, and overuse of the streams feeding the lake and the water of the lake themselves. It wasn't climate change. This same thing plays out in lots of places. And if any of you read the recent issue of the current issue, it's out in the exhibit hall of SC Journal. Jim Detchen and I and a number of other co-founders of SCJ opined about the big story for the next 25 years. And we pretty much said it's going to be climate change. But I did try to qualify my remarks by saying climate change itself is not so much the story as it is the most dramatic manifestation of what I consider the story, which is this overwhelming of land and the planet by humanity. And the second story that I'd bring to your attention relates to Syria. Not many people have probed the environmental roots of Syria's civil war, which very much connects to the waves of tens of thousands of refugees going to Europe right now and creating a pretty interesting news story in terms of how we deal with that, how Europe deals with that. Very few of them, people, reporters have looked at the environmental causes, but those that have frequently cited climate change, the idea that climate change caused droughts and that really created the sort of restive, miserable conditions. How much more? Okay. Thanks. And interestingly enough, papers that have looked at that have found that, in fact, there were two very severe droughts in Syria over the last 10 years that had an impact on agricultural production. But even these studies, one in particular by Colin Kelly and colleagues 2 years ago, I think it was, or last year, in Proceedings of the National Academies, PNAS, basically looked at population change. Population of Syria quintupled from more than quintupled from 4 million in the 50s to 22 million just before the civil war broke out, and noted that Syria had largely exhausted through mismanagement and through overuse its groundwater reserves, so that when these droughts hit, it did not have the groundwater reserves it needed. Well, groundwater reserves aren't depleted by climate change. They're underground. They're depleted by overuse. So why am I belaboring this point? I actually think it leads to very interesting environmental journalism if people will probe the numbers and look at the data. And demographic data, I hate to say it, is one of these things that used to be journalists would call me often and say, gee, you're a demographic type guy. Where's the data? The data is instantly accessible on the web. At the website of, and I gave it Elisa the site you can go to, the United Nations Population Division, readily accessible, good infographics, good graphs, good data that show what's happening. Now, I would love to talk about economic growth, particularly with Brian Check here and the question of how we deal with a steady state economy. It takes a lot of courage to take on the idea that economic growth has to go on everywhere, forever and ever, amen, which is certainly the current political and journalistic climate. I think one could possibly look at how we should rethink our economic models so that economic growth is targeted for the kind of people that Holger is particularly interested in, the poor and those who are most food insecure. There's clearly a role for some economic growth there. But is there a role for economic growth? Is it important that Europe and North America, Australia, New Zealand, Japan, these countries continually grow economically? There's a real question there, and it takes a brave journalist to take that on, but it's so related to these environmental problems. On population, and this will be my final thought, and this is part of the point of the project I'm involved in, this is a really interesting and good story. Mira's going to talk about it. One of the things that Mira looked at, she looked at the five elements of a sort of Hindu cosmology, and one of the elements is ether. It's called Akasha, I guess, in Hindu mythology. It's all around us, but we don't quite know what it is. This is population, and she followed it, and she'll tell you more about this, to some really interesting stories, really positive stories about what is happening to human population. Fertility rates are coming down, and they're very closely tied with the power that women have over their own lives, and the commitment that governments make to encourage women to manage their own lives, to make their own decisions. And in one particular element that's awkward to talk about but is really important, for women to be able to make choices about if, when, whether, and with whom they have a child. And when you explore that, you find some extremely interesting stories. And to my mind, they're some of the most positive things we can explore when we are looking at questions of, are we exhausting the planet? Will there be food security? And I'm really pleased to say that papers from all over the world that we looked at, especially for some reason in Africa by African researchers, pointed to this as one of the most hopeful aspects and important aspects of the future of food security.
Thanks so much. I know that the data that he refers to appears on the handouts that are available via PDF that I will email to you. Please, who has the notebook? Get your name on that email list. Pass it around. I have a bunch of great materials. It's several pages from the panelists up here, and I have some pages as well I will be sending you all with some great resources. In the meantime, so Bob, that is a follow-up question to you. Can you give us a couple of tips as reporters working on this? What tips would you provide us to better cover these kinds of stories?
Well, I don't think environmental reporters often think of themselves as sort of health, lifestyle, and what are they called in politics? Sort of the social issues that divide us all. So there's a reluctance to do that, but the connections are there to be seen. Illustrations domestically, like the Colorado program, privately funded, that provided long-acting reversible contraceptives free and at low cost to young people particularly, and absolutely slashed the proportion, and the evidence is very clear. It really isn't much disputed except by some people in the far anti-contraceptive movement. Teen birth rates. Not because their population was being controlled by any government, but because teens were actually preventing pregnancies they didn't want to occur. Teens are not the best people in the world at taking pills every day and doing the kinds of things that prevent pregnancy when they're having sex, but they do have a lot of sex. And long-acting reversible contraceptives are one of these amazing technologies. Mira referred in a tweet this morning to mental drones. I would say long-acting reversible contraceptives are what she's talking about, and I saw the drones this morning too. Fascinating technology that is actually having an impact on unintended pregnancy. Tim Wheeler's heard me say this, I think, 10, 15 times over the last 10 or 25 years. But he once came to me and said, gee, give me some more data on that. So salute to Tim on that. Half of U.S. pregnancies are unintended. Half of them. And a higher proportion in the population of people who have recently immigrated to the United States, or are there often the children of immigrants, who aren't as well connected to the health system. Now, that has a demographic impact. It's an awkward thing to talk about. Not many people feel strongly enough about it to bring it up. But I think it's there to be explored as long as you're not blaming the victim, as long as you're not suggesting that poor people having too many children are the cause of our environmental problems. On an international basis, look at a country like Tunisia that in the 1960s liberalized abortion, liberalized conception, and Absolutely. Raised the status of women. And if you looked at the news photos of Tunisian electoral politics, and it's the best democracy in the Arab world, women were all over the place there. That's a story that I didn't see covered. Why do you see all men in Egypt, but women campaigning for candidates in Tunisia? There's a reason for it. Explore it. Look at it. Fascinating, positive human interest stories. Thanks.
That's great. Yeah, I've actually talked to one of my fellow scholars when I was at the Wilson Center last year. She was the head of the Ministry of Science, and as a woman, you really promoted women in science in Tunisia, which they've made a lot of great strides there. So the next up is Jeff Hayward. He's the director of the climate program at Rainforest Alliance.
Thank you all. In the last 100 years, we've lost as much tropical forest as it took the globe to lose the same amount in 2,000 years. In Borneo, about 75% of its lowland rainforest is now gone. In the time since I studied at the University of Washington about Amazonian deforestation in the 1980s, 15% of the Amazon rainforest has been lost. And it loses about 500,000 hectares every year. In the 16 years since I've worked at Rainforest Alliance, at least 150 million hectares of forest has been lost. Our organization was set up almost 30 years ago, ostensibly to address the problem of deforestation. But the problem still marches on. We've had impact. We've helped to transform business practices and transform land use practices through connecting consumers and markets to sustainable forest and food products. But there is a lot of work left to do. We've helped to foster the stewardship responsibly of 50 million hectares of farm and forest globally. And we've positively impacted the lives of 5 million people. But there's still a lot to be done. By 2020, our organization is hoping to have 75 to 100 million hectares of land responsibly managed. And we'd like to see that 10 million hectares of that land is climate smart. And we would like to be providing training for 5 million farmers and forest-dependent communities. In order to do that, it's going to take a hell of a lot of work. Our organization works at origin, out in the field, in tropical countries, about 80 countries around the globe. And our overarching objectives heading into 2020 are really to conserve production landscapes and get out ahead of ecosystem destruction by helping to enhance the resilience of rural people and communities. And that's where we work in terms of agriculture and forestry and what we refer to as the land sector, that sector that contributes 25% of global emissions. We aim to promote climate smart agriculture by getting out there and helping to provide technical assistance and training that people actually need to undertake solutions that respond to climate change and respond to their needs to enhance productivity, their agricultural productivity, and to build food security by doing it through best management practices, highest quality standards of farm and forest management. And so what I'd like to do is just to bring it down to the level of the teams that work with me and the people that work in our organization and the folks that we collaborate with globally about what we mean by climate smart agriculture by providing a few examples of where we've been working globally. So one case is in Uganda. And high on the hillsides of Mount Elgon in Uganda, farmers, typically subsistence farmers, are usually subjected to periods of drought, not at sufficient rain, or too much rain that drastically erodes their soils. They have coffee farms with other subsistence agricultural crops. But they haven't had much technical assistance or investment into their production, and their coffee is very poor quality, and it has very low yields. So we teamed up with Taylors of Harrogate and DFID, UK aid agency, to work in a landscape on Mount Elgon with 6,000 farmers to bring climate-smart farming practices to them and to help them improve the productivity of their coffee. We did that by first establishing what we call farmer field schools, where we would train lead farmers, and those lead farmers can train others, as well as having model farms where demonstration practices clustered in communities throughout the landscape could help bring in people and disseminate information. And the sorts of things that we were working on with them was about soil conservation practices, mulching, drainage ditches to help control runoff. We were able to concentrate and cluster the treatment of coffee pulp that comes when you wash the berries and have a composting system, and then that composting system can be a natural fertilizer that goes into the farms and creates increased productivity of coffee. We were able to help work with them to better manage the water that's used in the washing of the coffee pulp and reduce water use significantly, and also to treat water waste considerably, which is important for health of people and health of the streams. By introducing better practices of how they manage the coffee trees themselves, the coffee bushes, through pruning and proper fertilizer placement and timing, we're able to help them increase their yield significantly. And also in terms of restoring the overall forest landscape, there was quite a number of trees planted through the project with nurseries set up. So that's a situation where we're improving people's lives directly through their mainstay, which is coffee production. Another example is in Ghana, in Western Africa, in the Western region, where the landscapes are typically dominated by cocoa production and cocoa farms. And it's often very similar in the sense that they're low producing, many times producing half of what the cocoa is capable of, extensive farming techniques, usually encroaching on the remaining forest. So climate smart agriculture with these farmers really meant helping them through the same type of farmer field schools to develop better practices to introduce restoration of trees, better placement of trees that serve as shade for the cocoa, so proper shade management, proper pruning practices for the cocoa, better fertilization through development of compost, as I mentioned earlier, restoration of fallow areas. And one of the things that gets beyond the soil management and the crop management is about their economic livelihoods and understanding what they need. And what we learned through working with 5,000 farmers in this landscape over about 35,000 hectares with the support of OLAM, which is an international cocoa trader, and USAID, was that farmers in the cocoa sector didn't want to only do cocoa farming. They also wanted to do beekeeping, and they wanted to do animal husbandry and raise livestock, and they needed training, and they needed some seed money to get those investments going, and that was something else that we provided. Further, they needed more community organization, and this is one of the things that's so fundamental, and often we miss this case, is that if communities are going to be sustainable, they need to be communicating to each other, they need to be sharing lessons learned, they need to have the governance spaces in order to organize and coordinate, and through setting up clusters of cooperatives and landscape management boards, you're able to help them to develop a better system for actual overseeing how the wider landscape is managed. Third example is in Ecuador. And in the Amazon of Ecuador, the Guamani peoples in Napo province of Ecuador would seem like the very best beneficiaries of a government reforestation program. the government was introducing a program to try to restore area of land that had been deforested. There were a few flaws with this program, and these were the things that we worked on to try to address. First, this reforestation program was all about commercial forestry, like setting up monocultures of fast-growing, high-yield tree species. Well, those tree species didn't even grow very well in the Amazon, and no one had ever really had any practice with them. Secondly, the people in this area were shifting cultivators. They were growing a crop called naranjillo, a small little orange fruit that's quite popular domestically. Well, if you're going to introduce a commercial reforestation plan, you have to, and into an agricultural community, you have to figure out a way to make the two mesh. And they weren't meshing at all. So what we did was work to figure out what are some native species that are from the Amazon that the people are familiar with and that they like and that they would use that would also enable them to grow this naranjillo. Could you do a mixed agroforestry system with native species and naranjillo? And could we develop a means of shifting and planning for the management over the next 20 years so that we could move from a time period when you have naranjillo and small trees, larger trees and naranjillo, to just larger trees, and then repeat and repeat and go around rather than encroaching out on the neighboring Amazon. And so that is what we developed, and that's what we worked on with these people. So those are three examples where Rainforest Alliance works through supply chains of commodity crops and tries to figure out local solutions that are helping local people increase their agricultural productivity, increase their revenues, and by so doing, really work to improve climate resiliency. I just would close and say that a lot of the things that our organization does and a lot that we talk about needing to do about climate-smart agriculture is nothing new. These are techniques that have been around for 30 or 40 years, many of them even longer, and it's just a matter of can you get them to the people that need them, can you get them to them in a way that fits with what they do locally, and can you adapt to institute practices and institute new forms of institutions that are needed at landscape level that will help people to take up best practices that are widely accepted and well recognized as actually solving problems.
Thank you. One of the questions I've been reporting on over the last year or so is the climate smart agriculture, and actually was in India recently touring some climate smart villages, looking at sort of this integration of approaches. Can you talk about the level of, some of the climate smart interventions, how, is it, I know that they're different throughout the world. What is it about having multiple things, multiple interventions, multiple of these climate smart ideas working together that sort of shores up that resilience or shores up their sustainable practices? So what, can you talk about that a little bit?
Okay, well, I had hoped that that's what I was doing in those examples. I was trying to illustrate climate smart practices in each of those three examples, but the thing about it is that we're trying to keep more carbon in the soil and in the system, because boosting carbon in terms of a climate smart lens is not just about mitigating greenhouse gas emissions. It's actually because carbon is so central to how fertile soil is and how well crops go. So you want to keep as much carbon in the system and build carbon in the system. So that's very important. The resilience aspect is one that is both agroecological in terms of how crops perform under stress. That's really important. And I think oftentimes that's what we focus on in climate smart. It's like we have drought, or we have too much rain, or we have unpredictable rain. And all this variability of precipitation and temperature is causing declining yields of crops. And so we have to focus on what's the solution crop-wise. But actually resilience gets into a lot more issues around households, management systems, governance processes, and it gets into things around economics and safety nets and how much resources you have for a rainy day or a drought. And then finally, it's really about the food security issue. If crop yields are going down and we're not able to maintain crop yields as they were, well, what's that going to imply for food security? It's going to mean undernourished people. It's going to mean starvation, or it's going to mean poor diets. And so it could imply the need for diversification of crops. And that's another thing that we're facing, is that what is the decision system that you need to follow to decide when is it time to move out of coffee and move into something else?
All right, next up is Mira, who has written this beautiful book that's available for sale, and So River Runs Again. I have mine autographed, so she's available for that as well. And so she'll talk about her reporting from India and give us some examples.
Thank you, Lisa. Actually, the bookstore apparently is not here anymore. They've left. But they sold out of the books already. So, but this is my SEJ promise. If you guys want to get a book and you tell me that you got it, you know, and you give me the SEJ wink wink, I'll send you a signed postcard and you can like glue it inside. So this question about are we exhausting our planet was a driving question as I was working on this book. India, I've gone there all my life. My father is from there, and I saw it change dramatically in my lifetime, especially when economic reforms kicked in the 90s. So I saw huge changes happening, but I also saw a lot of things that weren't changing. And when you look really closely at the numbers, there's still a lot of people really lacking some very basic development aspects, like 60% lacking access to clean water, and two-thirds still cooking over open fires for at least part of their energy and cooking needs. A quarter of the population not having electricity. So when there's a huge blackout like there was in June of 2012, and 600 million people are in the area of the blackout, compare that to like the little New York City, you know, 10 million or whatever. 600 million people live in this area, but half of those people never had electricity in the first place. So that India wants to develop its citizenry all around the world, we want to get these basic needs to people. But how do you do that without wrecking the planet? Where do you get power extra for 300 million people without building nuclear plants or coal-fired plants? How this question was really a driving impetus behind the book. I approached it with a combination of storytelling and science. I was trying to find individuals and organizations that were actively working to make this happen within their own communities. I went looking for hopeful stories. I think turning to India seemed like the place to focus because they are, again, looking at these UN population numbers that have been mentioned a couple times here this morning. India is set to outpace China as the most populous nation within 7 years. So by 2022, we're looking at India being the most populous nation on the earth. It's not a very big country. It's incredibly dense. And so I feel like what they are dealing with in terms of population pressures colliding with natural resource limitations is something that we're all going to be dealing with in the years and decades to come. Arguably, we're dealing with it now already with droughts and flooding, the changes that we're already seeing. So I went to India in search of stories, also talking and researching a lot of the science behind it, and using the five elements, as Bob mentioned, as a good framework to help it not be overwhelming to go cover the environment in India. So I used the Panchamahabhuta, is the, like Bob mentioned, the Hindu cosmology, and so that's earth, water, fire, air, and ether. And so for earth, I looked at organic agriculture, especially in the Punjab region, which was a very predominant focus of the Green Revolution that began in the 1960s and dominates definitely Indian agriculture as well as around the world, and has had huge impacts on health of both the people and the land and waters there. And I was looking at the people that are switching to organic farming and natural farming as a try to provide an antidote to that. And they were coming at it for all these different reasons, which was really fascinating. I met, you know, Gandhian revolutionaries, and I met young, hip engineers who like had this back to the land vision, and people were coming at it from very different angles, but all of them were working on trying to implement strategies that would help mitigate some of those problems that the country has been seeing in terms of the land quality. And then water, I went to Rajasthan. This is an area that basically the wells had all gone dry. Agriculture had and livestock just ceased to happen. The men left, the women were left behind, and about a generation ago, 20, 25 years ago, someone started an NGO that the Rain Man of Rajasthan, he's called now, Rajendra Singh, that the idea was just build small, tiny little check dams all over the place. So you're trying to capture fleeting monsoon rains, just stop them enough that there's time for them to percolate down to the groundwater. And as he tells the story, it was a village elder who told him, like, we don't need hospitals, we don't need schools, we need water. Build a dam. He says that he did that, and it seems to have worked. You know, it basically, wells that had been dry for decades started coming back, and the area is really vibrant again. And that just showed just the power of these small-scale efforts done on a wide landscape level. So we're not talking one mega dam or interlinking river projects, which India and Modi is really promoting right now, which would be like the largest engineering feat on Earth if this were to happen. We're talking about many, many small-scale. And I think about this for Oklahoma and Texas and California. Like, could we be implementing these landscape scale practices that don't have all of the negative things of these big projects? Fire was really complicated. I looked at fuel efficient wood cook stoves, since 2/3 of Indians are using biomass. Huge health implications. The new numbers just seem to keep going up. The latest global burden of disease study came out that 4 million people a year die from the inhalation of that cook stove smoke. So that's more than malaria and tuberculosis and HIV/AIDS combined worldwide. So we're talking about a huge health implication, mostly for women and children who are the ones who are cooking over the fires. And then combine that with a huge climate impact because of black carbon and the soot and the gases that are coming off of these fires. So I went looking for fuel-efficient wood cook stoves. In my 20s, I was doing that work for a nonprofit in Oregon, and I love these stoves, and I was so excited to go out and see them in the real world, and it was turned into a very different story, and it gets into, like, how do you say the name of your organization, Lisa? Sysnick? Sysink. Looking, they are taking a very multidisciplinary approach to, like, looking at these issues, because it is not just an engineering issue. It's not just about creating a good stove. It's about finding something that works for the people who are using them. And so that was part of that story. Air was about vultures. This was a whole fun story that actually started the book, which was there was a catastrophic vulture decline in India starting in the 90s that ended up being based on just an innocuous pharmaceutical drug that they give to cattle. They started giving it to livestock. Humans have taken it for years. We've probably all taken it in this room because it's in hundreds of formulations. And for whatever reasons, if an animal has been given this medicine, if the animal is sick and dies anyway, and the vultures feed on it, they just die. There's renal failure, so there's a huge collapse, and there's been religious implications to this for the Parsis, who lay out their dead for the vultures to eat. Thousands of years old practice that's no longer working, and conservation biologists are scrambling to try to do conservation breeding of a bird that had never been bred in captivity before, and also working to just get the diclofenac is the name of the drug, get it out of the environment so that they can start releasing some of these birds. There's been a huge victory, just a little aside. How am I doing with time? Okay. Of getting the big vials banned. So hopefully it'll become more and more inconvenient. Again, little tiny things that can have a widespread effect. Just make it a pain in the ass for the vets to, like, have to use all the different bottles to administer this drug, and that could be just enough of a barrier. And then the final section was ether. Like Bob had mentioned, I looked at, we needed to address population issues. I feel like it is a touchy subject. It's especially touchy in India. They dealt with forced sterilizations in the mid-70s that have a very, very lasting impact. And it's just tricky how to address who is responsible for reproductive health there. And the health system is in such dire shape. So I went to Bihar, which is one of the states that has some of the highest birth rates in some of the youngest brides, and I was working with an organization called Pathfinder that is doing reproductive health and sexual health training for teenagers. And that was kind of an amazing story. You give, there is so much hunger for knowledge, I think, everywhere. And if you give it to people, if you can get that to people, then they run with it. And that's what I experienced with the girls that I met in India. So I guess bringing what we're doing. So, you know, I was seeing things on the ground, and we're all working on, you know, I'm not an economist, I'm not a policymaker. Many of the people I met were not either. And it's how do we bridge the divide between these people that really are trying to take control of their lives and improve things with the amazing information that we are getting in the places that do have the resources. And
great. Thank you. Well, I'll be opening this up to the audience for questions, passing the mic around. If you can, please identify yourself and your affiliation. We'll open it up to journalists first and then others after that. And here we go.
Great, you guys, all of you. Marcia Johnson, I'm freelance. Did you go by Bobby? Did I hear you wrong?
Did not go by Bobby.
I thought I heard you say anyway.
But Bob will be
fine. Bob is fine anyway, Mr. Englund. Interested in your thoughts, and maybe Mira's too, but primarily, we were talking about this earlier. When and why did the discussions that dominated the 70s and the 80s, probably 60s, 70s, maybe a little in the 80s, about controlling population. Why did that stop? I mean, I have my own theories, but I'd be curious about your own.
Wow. That's way too long a question to answer here, so I'm tempted to pass. It's one of the ones I'm most often asked, and it's really hard. There's some things that I think are really obvious and some things that aren't so obvious. I think Roe v. Wade was one of the big impacts, to be honest with you. I think, and I hate to target one institution and seem to blame it, especially when it's particularly popular right now in the wake of Pope Francis's visit to the United States. But the Catholic Church got very mobilized and very frightened by Roe v. Wade, which happened right at almost the peak of the interest in population as an issue. And there was a conscious decision in the Vatican that, which had been through a lot of issues around humana vitae and the question of whether to actually say modern contraception was okay, which a lot of people thought it was going to do. They opted not to do that under papal infallibility, and they said we have to go after this whole issue. This is all connected, and so that was one issue. That's sort of a conspiracy issue, and maybe over paranoid. But I think one of the main things Mira mentioned, the forced sterilization in India, the China's one child policy began in the late 70s, and there was a lot of focus, a lot more attention to the poor, a lot more attention to women and women's rights. And there was a sense that if we got too worked up about population, it was going to come at the expense of women and poor women, women of color in the United States and everywhere and around the world. The differences in fertility, it got tied into immigration issues. Huge issue for the environmental movement when the Sierra Club tore itself apart about whether to oppose or take a strong stance on immigration for environmental reasons. So you throw in contraception, immigration, abortion, religion, and then you add the fact that sex is pleasurable. It's a lot of fun. We like to do it, but we're also very ambiguous and ambivalent about how we treat it. And I think there's also an economic thing that we just sort of are uncomfortable with the idea that we shouldn't keep having more and more people.
Okay. Hi, I'm Priyali, an independent journalist who's mostly reported out of India. My question is for Holger, though Mira kind of touched upon it. See, on one hand, we are talking about food security. We are talking about, you know, having more and more agricultural land to feed a population which is ever growing. And on the other hand, we are also talking about climate change. We are talking about renewable energy. So we talk about hydropowers, which pretty much actually take away the agrarian land. So for a developing country, which is largely based on agriculture, where do you strike a balance, and what do organizations like the World Bank, which actually deals with power on one side as well as food security and climate change on the other, mm-hmm. how do they strike a balance?
Yeah, thank you for that question. Quite frankly, I do not think there's an immediate competition for land between dams and agriculture. I mean, the areas we talk about, the numbers of hectares are minimal. The competition between energy and agriculture occurs around fuels. It is the question of how much land is being grown to corn for ethanol. How much land is being grown to corn for biogas to then be converted into electricity, and how much fertile land does that withdraw from the food circuit? And how much does that contribute to price spikes, particularly those like we've seen it in 2008, 2009, 2010, ever occurring food price spikes? And it's no surprise that at times where energy prices are relatively low, we also don't see these spikes in food. So if I have not misunderstood your question, to me, the immediate competition between building a dam for electricity and thus withdrawing land from agriculture is not an immediate one. When I think of dams, I have other questions that I ask with regard to the rural population. It is their livelihood being compromised? Is there involuntary resettlement? Are we building dams in areas that are critical for maintaining biodiversity? I mean, sorry, just a little excursion, one last sentence. I recently visited to a country down south of here, and I will not mention its name. And I wanted to see two things. I wanted to see rainforest, and I wanted to see tropical soils, because these were like ecosystems relatively new to a guy like me. I came to a landscape, and please approach me after the session, I show you a photo, where there was one tree left of Atlantic rainforest. In an entire landscape, and where, fortunately, I didn't have to go to the soil because the soil came to me. Right?
I can't guess what country.
Okay, thank you. This has been a great panel. My question is for Mira, and everyone, I really recommend A River Runs Again. It's a beautiful book. I reviewed it for SEJ, and it's just a great example of us at our best, environmental reporting at its best. Mira, I had a follow-up question on something you said. You said Punjab was a focus of the Green Revolution in the 1960s with huge impacts on the health of people, land, and water there. I'm afraid if people hadn't read your book, they may not know which side of the huge impacts you're referring to when you talk about the Green Revolution, because in my experience, sources see the Green Revolution in incredibly opposite ways. So I just thought you could elaborate on that for the audience. Thanks.
Sure. Thanks. India had famines as recently as 1943. Millions of people died. So the question of hunger was huge. When they became independent in 47, they were importing a lot of food. So like the reality was very present. It wasn't an intangible thing. And it was happening at the same time that the world was also recognizing that population was increasing and there was a lot of energy. And I think the Green Revolution, the methods of developing the Green Revolution, which was developing at its initial stages, developing hybrid seeds that worked really well in conjunction with a whole system of inputs that were fertilizer and chemical pesticides and insecticides and fungicides that helped it all grow, combined with excessive amounts of water. If you buy that entire package, the food production skyrocketed. Everybody was sold on it immediately. And it was highly subsidized. Things were given for free. Helicopter springs came gratis. You didn't have to pay for the electricity to pump water out of the wells, which is still true in Punjab. And all of that worked, but those yields went up, and then they sort of leveled. And the I almost said drugs. The chemicals that were being used on the crops that were working so well lost effectiveness. This has like been also part of the pattern, and we've heard about this in Oklahoma of super weeds that are no longer that are now have built up a resistance. Like, biology is amazing. Biology, life responds to things really quickly. So that is what is happening in the agricultural realm as well as everywhere else. So in terms of the impacts, the water table is dropping 2 feet a year in Punjab. The nitrate levels in the water have increased tenfold in the 40 years that the Green Revolution has been in effect. They think that they might not have potable water there, like within 20 years, if not less. So we're talking about a whole system that is potentially going to crash if they keep heading in this direction. And so I think the Green Revolution was, I feel like it was started with the best intents. I think there just wasn't enough humility around the question of what the impacts were going to be or how long the system would last, because there's been a lot of, I don't know if anybody has not heard of no-till while we've been here in Oklahoma, that's come up a lot. This whole idea of building the soil over time for a long-term system, as well as, like Jeffrey mentioned, carbon storage. Land is an incredibly valuable place to store carbon, and so how do we make that work for us instead of, you know, killing it?
I'm Doug Struck, freelance, Boston. Mira just touched on the answer to this, but I really wanted to address to Holger. The trends that you talk about are sobering and alarming also. But in 1968, Paul Ehrlich wrote The Population Bomb and predicted that there would be a collapse of civilization in the 70s and 80s. That didn't happen. Is there any, I mean, how do you square the sort of doomsday trends that you talk about, and that's my word, not yours, but the alarming trends that you talk about with the kind of hysteria that went on then?
The reason why I hesitate is that I'm just asking myself, did I come across as doomsday? I did definitely not mean to come across as doomsday, because I think there's huge opportunity in the sector. I mean, I fully agree. Agriculture is the only sector that can sequester more carbon than it can release. No other industry can do that. In it is a massive opportunity, both a physical one, like carbon sink, and here you go into science, an economic one for farmers to bring to the market the carbon sequestration they are conducting. But the population question, actually, I mean, you made that point in your intervention. See, I would not want to couple the question of do we need a different agriculture to the background numbers of whether we are dealing with a 6 or 9 billion population, higher or lower. We have shown, mankind has shown, that even with 5 billion population, we have not been able to conduct sustainable agriculture. The agricultural model we've been pursuing globally in the past 50 years is not a sustainable one. I repeat, we've been successful in producing enough calories for the number of people that live on the planet, but we've neither been doing it in a sustainable way, nor have we been doing it in a way that ensures distribution. And finally, on distribution, a concept that I think we really should talk about, perhaps after the session, is the one of agricultural migration. We've heard about people migrating from one country to the other for various reasons, but there's also agricultural migration happening. Look at the map of Colombia, one of the prime coffee producers. All predictions are that in 20 years, the area where Colombia can meaningfully produce coffee will shrink. Côte d'Ivoire on cocoa, the same. And so I could show you a number of pictures of projections. We will face most probably quite an agriculture migration. Now, is that doomsday? No. But it also means that we need to adjust incentives so that farmers can meaningfully adjust to different production systems or patterns. You mentioned that. I mean, where's the point that you should incentivize or advise to get out of coffee and into what else to maintain livelihood? I'm not concerned of the coffee. There will be coffee. There are producers of coffee in California now that can sell whatever kilogram, whatever ton, whatever pound they produce. The question is, how do we structure a policy response? Because in the end, it's all about incentives. And most governments in the world do not set the incentives at this point in time for agriculture to change its behavior. Subsidies are usually in favor of productivity and continuing to do what we've perhaps done best in the past couple of years. Sorry for spending so much time on it.
I just wanted to add a couple thoughts to that. I wanted to put the questioner together with Peter Seidel, who has a book that I think he's probably willing to sell cheap or give away copies of, that I think provides some interesting perspective on how dire the predicament is and how much hope there is for dealing with it. I get this a lot, and I want to push back a little bit. Ehrlich didn't predict the collapse of civilization. He did say that tens of millions of people would be starving in India in the 70s, and he really got that wrong, in part for the reason that Mira suggested. Like Thomas Robert Malthus didn't predict that North America would have great farmland and productivity would increase, Ehrlich wasn't doing his reporting to know that people were working on the Green Revolution at the time that he wrote. But I would argue that this is a little bit like the people who say, well, climate change can't be real because in the 70s, everybody was talking about the world freezing over. Everybody was not talking about the world freezing over. There was not a scientific consensus that the world was getting colder. It was just a handful of scientists and then a lot of media hype. And by the same token, the idea that we were going to have doomsday in 70 was Paul Ehrlich, basically, and maybe one or two other people, and a lot of media hype. But I would actually credit Ehrlich, who I have a lot of respect for and know well, as I would credit Malthus with actually raising awareness of critical collisionary dynamics between finite natural resources and continually increasing human demands. One way we've beaten them is through successful use of technology. But those technologies have side effects too. And it's a real question of whether we can play that game forever. The environmental community is divided right now about biological engineering. Maybe we can engineer nature so that it will support us no matter how many people we are and how much stuff we want to have. Well, that's a really interesting question journalists should grapple with. Should we re-engineer the planet through genetic engineering or through that kind of approach? Or should we take climate-smart agriculture and putting carbon in soils and contraception and the empowerment of women?
So I have a question that is probably too big for the time remaining, but I did want to ask it. Even though overall fertility is declining, there are still pockets of very, very high fertility, and many countries still have very youthful age structures. How is working with youth, such as what Mira talked about with the adolescent sexual health programs, but also with young farmers, you know, how is there a focus on youth that can help us with this challenge?
I'd love to take that. I mean, one of the most striking things that I found was Kerala is one of the states in the South. They halved their birth rate from average of four children per woman to two in one generation. And they did that by making family planning resources accessible and comprehensive health care and education. There have been studies that education is the single most determining factor for how many children a woman will have. It cuts across class, religion, ethnicity, all of the other ways to be human. Just educate people and that makes that happen. And not to mention this other cascade of positive effects that happen from that. So that's what
I actually have a follow-up question for Jeff, as opposed to sort of what our consumptive patterns are, you know, with the pressure of the number of people choosing to consume the products that we do, and putting pressures on the world forest. I mean, is it demographics where people live causing a lot of the pressure, or is it our food choices and what we grow? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I think it's clearly our food choices. If you think that we want to eat more beef, and we clearly do, not just in the West or the North, but certainly in areas where we're not traditionally accustomed to eating beef, like China and Southeast Asia. And to produce beef, we need either more pasture land, or we need more soybean or more corn. And soy is one of the largest responsible commodity crops for deforestation, especially in Paraguay, but also in the savannas of Brazil. And we all know the story of cattle and rainforests, and that continues to this day. The extent to which we want to eat more processed foods that need vegetable shortening, there's palm oil, and that's responsible for most of deforestation occurring in Southeast Asia right now. So whether we're making these choices consciously or they're being made for us by the brands that produce the products that we eat and consume, we have to try to get those systems to change. And I think, you know, we're talking a lot about climate smart agriculture. We maybe don't know exactly what that is, but I think there is climate stupid agriculture. And I think destroying ecosystems to grow palm oil and to grow cattle and to grow soybeans when there are sufficient degraded areas to put those crops on just is climate stupid.
I'm going to, we need to wrap it up now, regrettably. I believe everybody here will be here for most of the day. I would like each of you, in the order of where you gave your opening remarks, to please just give a, like a closing sentence or, you know, what you could talk about in the future and so on. And if you arrived late or people were coming and going here, I passed around a notebook with for you to put your email down so I could send you great materials that these people had prepared at links and for data and so on. So please go ahead if you have anything final remarks to say.
I thank you very much for your interest. If there's one thing that I want to bring to your attention in closing, it's this brochure. It's called The Future of Food, Shaping a Climate Smart Global Food System. It was released just yesterday. It is not deep academic thinking. It is a synthesis of messages for policymakers that fit into even the busiest day and the shortest attention span. And yes, please download it or approach me and I will make sure you get a reasonable number of copies.
Well, I'm not an optimist, but neither am I a pessimist. I think if I'm anything, I probably come closest to being a Buddhist. So I try to appreciate the present with non-judgment and non-attachment. But I think we're in a world of trouble. I think we have a huge, we're facing, one of the wonderful things about being an environmental journalist, which set me on my path since leaving journalism 23 or 4 years ago, is that you have the luxury of sort of looking at these interacting forces and seeing how the world works and how it fits together and what sorts of responses are being made. And as I think Holger and Jeff have both indicated, and certainly Mira, there are some really incredible responses, but they're not proportional to the threats we face yet. So that's the real question. Are we going to make these responses proportional? And to me, the hope is that governments that don't manage to serve their people's needs do not survive historically. We find new ways of organizing ourselves and new ways of governing ourselves, and we're going to need to find new economic models that do not rely on constant growth without thinking about its side effects for nature and its side effects for other human beings, especially in terms of rising inequality, which is one of the world's biggest problems right now. But I think we'll figure that out because governments fail when they don't figure these kind of things out. The other big hope is women. The world really is moving toward the way it moves, has moved toward racial equality, toward gender equality. And I think Mira's work demonstrates this well, and I agree with everything she said. Education, access to reproductive health, decent status, ability to make decisions about your own lives. That's tremendously encouraging. That's the future. The future world that I'm looking toward will have equal status for genders and smart economies and smart governments. And I think we're going to be in a world of trouble, but I think we'll come through it on the other side with probably a better human civilization, although probably a biologically poorer and much hotter planet.
Jeff.
Yeah, I don't know what the future will bring. I just hope that in the reporting on the environment, you can continue to shed light on the fact that we're in this era of the Anthropocene and that we are the source of so much of the degradation that's occurring. And so we need to keep looking at how human systems, political and social and interfacing with the ecological, are affecting the planet we live on, and looking at ways to take the little things in the small scale and link them up to the big things in the structural, and vice versa, work from the top and go back down. And I also hope that you continue to emphasize the importance globally of educating people on climate change, because I really do think it's important. And education is central to women's empowerment, to echo what Bob just said.
Yes, I agree with all my fellow panelists and everything they said. I mean, I think something that Jeff said earlier was that a lot of these practices they're already there. And in some ways, it's tapping into how we did everything before everything was so industrialized. And so if we take the best of what we've learned with technology and with this high-tech world that we live in now, and we combine it with how people lived when they were very deeply connected to their land and knew that they just wanted to make it last. Like, if we can bring those two things together, I think that there is, that's where we can find the most hope.
Excellent. Thank you, everybody. I actually was in Punjab looking at some of the farmers doing climate smart agriculture, and they were doing the no-till practices along with a bunch of other things. But it was actually, for many of them, the education of women in their families to be able to support them to do that, because when you have a field that's not tilled, it looks really messy, and so the women thought that the men were being lazy and not tilling the agriculture. But when the women were brought along and to be participants and understand the importance of this, they realized they were a critical part of the decision making in the household. And so, I think that there are so many stories out there to tell. I am working on a book called Hot Hungry Planet with a website of the same name. So I've got hothungryplanet.com. I'll be posting some of my reporting as I go along. I'm not doing a very good job of putting that out there, or putting my stories up there because I've been so busy. But I will be doing more of that. So please take a look at that if you have time. So, and I will include a link to that, right, good idea, in the materials I'll be sending out. People have cards up here, but we'll be around most of the day to talk. Thank you very much.